Hello, and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This episode, we chat to Dr. Samir Puri, author of Russia's Road to War with Ukraine. Samir's perpetual ringside position at major Ukrainian events has made him an authority on Ukrainian affairs. His time as both an international observer at five Ukrainian elections, combined with a year spent on the front line in East Ukraine as part of an international ceasefire monitoring mission, has fueled his innate understanding of Ukrainian affairs. Samir is currently a senior fellow in hybrid war at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, the geopolitical think tank, and he is also a visiting lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Hi Samir, great to have you on this episode of Bite Back Chats Books with me, Nell Whitaker, and Ryan Norman.
Great, well, thanks very much for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure, especially as our conversation today is around the six-month anniversary mark of the conflict. Now, since the conflict began, there's been a surge of publications around the history attempting to explain the war. Your book has the advantage of your first-hand experience in Ukraine to ask more accurately how we got here. As more books will be written in years to come, however, on this conflict, what exact details do you hope will be accurately recorded? And then what do you expect will be twisted or misrepresented in time to come?
I mean, the real motivation for writing Russia's Road to War with Ukraine was exactly those personal experiences. And I worked in Ukraine not only in the first Donbass war in 2014-15, but also a decade before that in the Orange Revolution in 2004. So I'd seen the evolution of Ukraine. I'd seen the evolution of its relationship with Russia. And that was why I wrote the book, to be able to tell that story to a wider readership, many of whom will have come to Ukraine for the first time this year. It won't have been on their radar beforehand, and why would it have been? Now it's the biggest issue of the day. In terms of the books that are going to come, there'll be many more books to be written about Ukraine, of course. Clearly, those books to come will reverse engineer some of the narrative based on the outcome of the war. So we're in the middle of a war, and some people say, well, it's crazy to write a book when no one knows who's going to win the war or how it's going to end. And I said, well, that's kind of the point. I don't want to write about who's going to win because I don't know how it's going to end. No one knows. But what I wanted to write about was how we got here, how we got to this point where Russia would launch this, you know, extraordinarily ambitious, over-ambitious invasion that somewhat backfired, but has devastated Ukraine utterly, and also devastated Russia's economy and wrecked its armed forces in the process. Future books will reverse engineer their arguments to reflect whatever outcome actually results. Mm. And I suppose one benefit of writing it as the invasion is just in its early months is that I cannot be sort of accused of tainting the content of the book on the basis of any given outcome. I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm actually presenting this war not as a morality play of democracy versus autocracy, not as this sort of act of, you know, genocidal evil. It is all those things, but it's actually just a tragedy because we're looking at tens of thousands of people killed. We're looking at millions of people displaced. And I just want to ask, how did we get to this point where two neighboring countries in Europe in the 21st century could end up in this sort of conflict where one is utterly devastating the other, having received no provocation to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan, I know you had some thoughts editorially on this.
No, I was just going to say that Samir did a great job of sticking steadfastly to that project throughout the editing process, because I was the editor on this book. And as an editor, I'm guilty of liking complete narratives in our book. So I felt foul of recommending that we kind of not necessarily look for a firm point of conclusion to Samir's narrative, but I tried to kind of direct him in the final chapters to, you know, asking the question, what are the potential outcomes here for all the parties? And he did humor me and say, you know, there are some places that this could end up, but that, you know, that's not the project here. People are asking, how have we got to this point? That's the question that we need to answer. And as he says, you know, we don't know. This could go on for an awful long time. There are so many moving parts.
Exactly. So with this question, we don't know who will win, and understanding the proper conflict,
if you could give this exact book to three influential people at any point in history to understand why this has happened or what's going to happen, who would you choose?
That's a fabulous question. And I think it's really the time at which you give them this book. If you had this sort of proverbial time machine, sort of walking in their sort of reading room and say, by the way, this little artifact from the future, this is how badly it's going to go. And I really hope you pay heed. So I think going sort of backwards in time, I'd start with Viktor Yushchenko, who was the Ukrainian leader just after the Orange Revolution in 2004. I'd go back to 2005 and I'd say, Viktor Yushchenko, you want your country to join NATO. And that's when Ukraine's quest to join NATO really kicked off. And there's actually quite a bit of ambition within Ukraine and Ukrainian politicians that they could actually secure what would be known as a NATO membership action plan, a map that would put you on the path to one day joining NATO. And I'd sort of deliver the dose of reality that this isn't going to come. And Ukraine wasn't even close even before the invasion. The implication is Ukraine is undefended by treaty allies. And I'm not making moral judgment about, the good or bad of anyone in this. I'm just simply saying to the Ukrainian leader, you want your country to join NATO, it's not going to get there. The next person, it would have to be Vladimir Putin. And I'd say sort of the early 2000s, not long after he's become the president for the first time. And I would say to Vladimir Putin with this book that your appeals to sort of fraternal relations between Russia and Ukraine are not strong enough and they're going to fall on deaf ears. Because one thing that's really characteristic of Russia's engagement is they've prioritized manipulation of Ukraine's elections. They've prioritized meddling with Ukraine. And the soft power, what we call soft power, is actually a really weak part. It's really badly developed. I'm not trying to give the guy advice here, but like my only incentive would really be in doing this is Ukraine's stability. So we avoid all this death and destruction that we're seeing now. And the final person is Bill Clinton. I'd go back to the early 90s and I'd say, President Clinton, you've got a bunch of advisors, you've got a bunch of officials who are really pushing for the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe. And I just want you to see how this will end up in the not so much expanding NATO, but the way you're doing it, which is bringing in former parts of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union and giving them the full security guarantee straight away and not really thinking about what Russia might do in terms of its resentment around this. And just to round off that answer, I'm sort of thinking very much about people like Madeleine Albright, Strobe Talbot, officials who served under the Clinton administration. They pushed what history would show, and I document this in the book, as quite a quite a brave set of assumptions about NATO expansion in Russia that proved over the decades to be wrong. And that's not casting aspersions on them and their judgments in the 1990s, but governments, the US in particular, because it's so powerful, they need to reassess their assumptions in the years and decades as they move forward. And I don't think the USA sensibly reassessed its assumptions around what NATO expansion meant for Ukraine in particular, as we get sort of into the 2010s and closer to this invasion.
Some really interesting answers there, Sumit. Just to pick up on a couple of them. So if you were to tell Ukraine that this ambition that large parts of the country have to join these Western alliances like NATO, if you were to say realistically it's not going to happen, and then simultaneously say to Vladimir Putin, the sort of soft power that you're trying to exert over Ukraine, it's that's also not working, do you think that a more kind of realistic, long-lasting form of peace could have been, as opposed to vying for a stronger tie to the West, actually having stronger ties to Russia?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's about how Ukraine could have coexisted between Russia and an expanding NATO. That's the exam question, and to do so with in peace and in relative stability. And certainly, I think the thing that wrong-footed the protagonists when you go through the history is that unlike many other parts of the former Soviet Union, Ukraine did not suffer armed conflict when the USSR collapsed. And actually, as we know from empires all around the world, when there's an imperial retreat, an imperial collapse, there's sometimes massive bloodshed, sometimes with the former imperial overlord, sometimes within factions of the country itself. Yeah, Vietnam, Kenya, Cyprus, but closer to the USSR, of course, Georgia and others, they've all experienced conflict at the point of imperial collapse. Ukraine didn't. And Ukraine was actually peaceful between 1991 and 2014. And that, I think, wrong-footed people. I think it may have created an exaggerated sense of confidence that Ukraine could be tugged east, could be tugged west, could be kind of fought over as a geopolitical prize by ambitious statesmen and women on all sides of this line, because, of course, you know, Russia wants to keep Ukraine in its embrace. And NATO, some people in NATO countries, some people in EU countries want to westernize Ukraine. And there are Ukrainians who've sort of felt across the time that we're looking at, these 30 years since 1991, have felt, you know, sort of a pull of affinity in both directions. Now it's almost certainly, you know, Ukrainians want to join Western institutions because they've been invaded and their people are being murdered by the Russians. But again, that's not the point of this book. The point of this book is to look back before this invasion, and as you said, to see how we got here and to reassess critically the assumptions in Ukraine and also from outsiders around what Ukraine's ultimate fate could and should be.
Absolutely. It's such an important question. Yeah. We just want to kind of like open the discussion up a little bit here and consider the war, not necessarily in context of more global affairs, but perhaps in relation to some global affairs. So one parallel issue that some people have been discussing is the issue with China and Taiwan. Now, there are people that say that because what we've seen is Russia wage essentially a reunification war with Ukraine, having, you know, established a strong partnership with China in the process, do we need to be concerned about the possibility of China waging a reunification war against Taiwan? Now, of course, China doesn't fully recognize the autonomy of Taiwan. Taiwan's not declared itself formally independent. I think it's fairly well accepted that China does want Taiwan to kind of come back to the motherland at some point. But yeah, I don't know. Do you think that that's a realistic threat?
Yeah. And so one of the sort of accidents of timing is that I've actually been in Singapore for work for much of the last sort of couple of years, including when this conflict in Ukraine broke out, actually to work on Asian security issues. I've obviously sort of temporarily put that on hold because of the gravity of what's happening in Ukraine to write this book. But I have got a sort of an interesting view coming at this from my geographic location in the Asia Pacific. Yeah. And that is that concern around China and Taiwan is at the highest it's been probably in my lifetime. There's been crises between them ever since the Chinese Civil War ended in 1949, which is when the, you know, Chiang Kai-shek and the Taiwanese, the Chinese nationalist forces retreated to Taiwan. It's been a standoff ever since. There are some interesting and worrying parallels between Russia, Ukraine, China, Taiwan. Certainly the power of historical grievance, that is a huge factor. I think the residual power of empire and imperial thinking is another massive factor in terms of power emanating respectively from Moscow and Beijing and where that sort of natural domain ends. Interpretations within those sort of imperial capitals, if you like, of cultural affinity to people who now live in either fully independent sovereign states like Ukraine or, in the case of Taiwan, sort of ambiguous sort of status it holds, in which it's treated almost like an independent state, certainly by the Americans these days, but it's not. There's that sort of willful ambiguity that allowed Taiwan and China to coexist without war for much of, you know, the year since 1949. The big differences, I would say, in these scenarios, there's one big difference of size. You know, Russia is a sort of 180 plus million, Ukraine sort of nearly 50 million people. But Taiwan's sort of less than half the population size of Ukraine, and China is many times the population size and size of economy as Russia. And I've also, I have actually been to an event with the head of the US 7th Fleet, which is interestingly the military formation that would be involved in responding to a Taiwan contingency. And of course, this is a naval theater that we're talking about here. And the ability of the US and Taiwan's other partners to reinforce it, even if they don't get involved, is just of a different you know, different sort of shape and size of a problem compared to reinforcing and supporting Ukraine, which actually NATO has done pretty well without getting involved. It's providing intelligence support, military supplies, and sort of moral support and out-of-country training to the Ukrainian armed forces. If you were to sort of roll that model into a sort of supporting a future Taiwanese defense of Taiwan against a Chinese naval airborne missile invasion, everything else, it's actually really hard, but it'd also be hard for the Chinese because they can't just drive over a border like Belarus, Ukraine, as the Russians did. They actually have to move large numbers of men and material over the Taiwan Straits, which I think the assessments at the moment suggest that although China still wants a peaceful reunification, that the Chinese leadership is coming around to the understanding that peaceful reunification is actually not likely. So they'll be thinking about their military options more realistically now.
Mm. And you say thinking about your military options, and as we're talking about in Britain, it's boiling sunshine, or it has been, but it's going to get a lot colder. And historically, looking at wars of the past with Russia, they can't fight in the winter. Do you think modern warfare now is advanced enough for Putin to continue through the Russian winter, or is this just a race against time?
Yeah, that, and where we're sort of sitting now, the sort of 6-month anniversary of this awful Russian invasion, we really are looking at the rest of 2022 and thinking, will there be a Ukrainian counteroffensive? How long do they have till winter sets in? I mean, the way to answer this is the year I spent when I worked in Donbass in that first Donbass war. I was there throughout the winter. And I think the real problem for armored vehicles and tracked vehicles is when the ground goes to mush. So, you know, I'm not a tank expert, but I worked with plenty of tank experts because we were monitoring a ceasefire. And, you know, there are certain terrain and weather conditions that armored vehicles can still move through. There's issues with engines, of course. There's issues with logistics and logistic chains, which become harder as the weather becomes colder. But I think the winter is actually going to be a very convenient excuse for Russia and Ukraine, because no armed force can continue fighting at the intensity they've been fighting each other at indefinitely. And the history of warfare shows that you sometimes have, you know, sort of cessations of hostilities or even putative peace deals because the sides are exhausted, need to rearm, resupply, and need to gather their strength. And I think that's going to be a factor as well. Again, no one can predict how the next 6 months are going to pan out. They're going to pan out very differently to the first 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the big fear I have, and this is something I talk a lot about in the book, even though I can't predict what's going to happen, is that as the ground freezes over, as Ukraine's winter descends, and I remember this well, it's sort of minus 25. It's a very strange feeling to be walking around rural Ukraine in minus 25. We would do so visiting, you know, the trench systems that the Ukrainians had, part of our regular patrolling activity. As that sort of winter sets in, you know, we may actually see the onset of what you call a frozen conflict, metaphorically as well as literally, in which the sides kind of hunker down because of the winter, because of this exhaustion issue. And they hunker down over this sort of front line that reflects a de facto partition of Ukraine, that unless Ukrainians can actually retake all of their territory with their counteroffensives, is going to be Ukraine's medium-term reality, whether the shooting is carrying on or not, that the Russians don't want to leave and look like at the moment, certainly from the Donbass region, no one's going to push them out yet.
Mm. And is it foolish to assume that Putin would not use nuclear warfare in the next 6 months to get this done in his eyes?
Yeah, so the nuclear threat really looms large over the war in Ukraine. Actually, if some of you might remember, listeners might remember, the first Russian advance back in February, March to Kiev, they actually captured Chernobyl. Just, I think I say that out of the symbolism everyone knows about Chernobyl and the nuclear disaster. And they held Chernobyl for a while, and then they withdrew because they gave up on trying to sack Kiev. So I think that sort of nuclear threat, that nuclear theme has really been in our minds ever since the start of the Russian invasion. I think there's two really big nuclear threats in this conflict. The first is the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. It's been in the news quite a lot because the Russians occupy it. They don't actually occupy Zaporizhia town. There's sort of a river that separates these two places, and rather sensibly with the urban planning, the nuclear plant is a bit far out from the town. So Ukraine controls Zaporizhia town, Russia controls the nuclear plant, and Russia is has been accused of nuclear blackmail, of almost sort of threatening that they're going to destroy the plant. They haven't said that, but they have, of course, positioned their military forces in and around the nuclear power plant. And we have to really worry about this, because if there's a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive quite close by in Kherson and also in the south, what could the Russians do to this nuclear plant if they think they're going to lose their grip over it? Could they try to sabotage it in some way, try to destroy it in some way? That's one fear. The other fear that I think from a military perspective has to be taken very seriously is the possibility of a Russian use of what will be called a tactical nuclear weapon. Very simply, that is a lower yield nuclear weapon that is designed, and they've existed since the Cold War, for battlefield use, has a more contained blast radius, and therefore, you know, you could drop it on, the Russians could fire a sea or surface launched sort of ballistic missile with tactical nuclear warhead. At where? I can think of a couple of things that would keep me awake in terms of this scenario. It's very horrifying to think of this. Possibly at Western Ukraine, to punish Ukraine for taking those supplies of NATO weapons that are coming across the Polish border. That's horrifying to think. But also potentially even a concentration of Ukrainian forces that are getting ready and gearing up for a counteroffensive. I desperately hope this doesn't happen, but Vladimir Putin has shown he has no compunction when it comes to inflicting massive loss of life in pursuit of his sort of neo-imperial goals. And that, I think, is really worrying. I would probably place on the spectrum the threat of nuclear annihilation between NATO and Russia very low down, because I think NATO is very aware of this and therefore is not fighting in Ukraine. That's the big fear, of course, that if you start fighting, if you're British, you're American, shoulder to shoulder with Ukrainians, that this could actually escalate between Moscow, London, Washington, and Paris and other capitals that are part of NATO.
Some really interesting answers there. And I think, obviously, you can't exactly predict the future, but your first-hand experience and expert knowledge through writing this book really has given us a better picture. And I think our readers and our listeners will be looking out for your book, which is out on the 25th of August. And Samir, thank you so much for chatting to us this morning.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm really pleased that we've been able to get this book together, I think, in a really meaningful timescale for people who are concerned about what's happening in Ukraine, people who are working on Ukraine, whether it's in the charity field, in the military field, or in any sort of field where you're trying to help Ukraine, and to give you sort of a one-stop shop in bringing your sort of knowledge up to speed around what may have appeared to come out of nowhere this February. But, you know, as we've discussed, if you've been following Ukraine, working in Ukraine, know Ukraine, then you can see the sort of the portent of this catastrophe slowly developing. And it's really an alarming tale when you see this sort of slow move to the edge of a cliff. And I hope that readers will be able to get a better sense of how we got here from the book. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Bite Back podcast. Russia's Road to War with Ukraine is available to buy now online and in store. If you enjoyed this discussion, you might also be interested in our quickfire questions and answer session with Samir on our website. And now, an added bonus. We had one more, slightly less somber, but nonetheless revealing question for Samir.
If you were a kitchen utensil, what do you think you would be?
I would definitely be that really funny thing that is used to stir and pick up spaghetti. I actually don't even know if it's a spaghetti spoon. I've always been fascinated by its design, and I think it's probably quite multi-purpose. I think you can use it for all sorts of things. So I'd be a spaghetti serving spoon.
Good thinking.
Great answer. Thank you so much, Samir.